Well, you can't run an open society when every single member of that society is eavesdropped, photographed, monitored, and has all of their electronic communication stored in perpetuity in government supercomputers. That is so egregiously unconstitutional and dangerous, and I speak as a journalist, because the primary role of a free press is to hold power accountable, to shine a light on the inner workings of power. And the only way that you can do that is when you have people who have a conscience within the systems of power who are willing to reach out to the press. And with complete and total surveillance, anyone who attempts to reach out is swiftly identifiable and punished. And we have seen the Obama administration misuse the Espionage Act, which is not – never designed. It was against people who were giving state secrets to enemy governments. Misuse the Espionage Act against traditional whistleblowers, whether that's Thomas Drake or Kiriakou or Edward Snowden or anyone else. So that's what I mean when I say that.
You think, for example, Edward Snowden and Julian Assange and Chelsea Manning are basically heroes?
Hero, that's kind of absolute term. It wouldn't necessarily be my word.
What would your word be?
Well, I think that they have tremendous amounts of courage and have done us a great public service. Now, Julian Assange never leaked anything. He functioned more as a publisher, and that stuff was leaked to him in the same way the Pentagon Papers were leaked to the New York Times. I do think we have to separate Julian Assange from Snowden and from Manning. Manning, whose trial I attended at Fort Meade in Maryland, exposed egregious war crimes, and those who carried out those war crimes were never put on trial. I don't actually have a problem with carrying out a judicial process against Snowden or against Manning, but I think that they should be allowed, and Manning was not allowed to raise a defense that they leaked this information for the greater good. And I don't think that it's appropriate to carry out judicial processes against these people until you have carried out or brought to trial those who committed these crimes, including Clapper, who committed – our intelligence director of national intelligence, who committed perjury in front of the Senate committee.
When he said that they weren't spying on average citizens.
Sure. Of course, the president also didn't tell us the truth. Yeah.
You mentioned the Pentagon Papers. Why do you think at that time Daniel Ellsberg was seen as a hero?
Well, he wasn't at the time. At the time, he was utterly vilified.
But the public reaction eventually was sympathetic.
Eventually. And I think eventually the public reaction towards – well, you know, what's interesting. I was on the way out here. I read a poll that 77% of Republicans in this country oppose what the NSA is doing. And this comes directly from Snowden. This is not a left-right issue. Our right to privacy is not it falls on all ends of the political spectrum. And I think you're seeing that reflected in the polls. And the information that Snowden has provided is really – and I speak as a reporter who covered the East German communist Stasi state, where you had an informant for every 63 citizens and a full-time government security agent for roughly every 100,000 citizens. So, every 116 citizens. So, I know what those states are like, and you don't want to give government that kind of power. And this has nothing to do with being a Republican or a Democrat or, you know, a libertarian or, you know, a member of the left wing or anything else.
It's not just government that you're worried about. You've also written that we're living under, quote, corporate totalitarianism.
Sure. No, I mean, look, you have Senator Max Baucus here, whose primary employer is the health insurance industry. Isn't he going on to be a lobbyist, I think, for them after he leaves here?
Actually, he's been nominated to be ambassador to China.
Oh, okay. Well,
and will likely be confirmed.
Okay, great. But he certainly received a lot of money, and he did their bidding. And destroy the public option, which many of us were fighting for. That's universal health care for all. And that's just a small example. I don't want to pick on him because he's no different from anyone else in Washington. And again, this crosses party lines. The Democrats are as beholden to corporate money as the Republicans. And meanwhile, we, the citizen, our interests, because we don't have lobbyists and suitcases full of cash are ignored.
You think that really this is a dire time to be living in, and you have written, quote, "The most daunting existential struggle of our time is to rise up to resist the forces that are destroying us."
Well, let's and I'm referring to the climate, to climate change. You know, we have just watched the State Department pass a quote-unquote review of the XL pipeline.
Keystone
pipeline, which, you know, I grew up in farm country. I know what aquifers mean to farmers. It's their lifeblood. You know, if we do not halt and radically reconfigure our relationship to the ecosystem, we will be extinguished as a species. I mean, you know, even the World Bank, which is hardly a radical organization, put out a very dire report that said that if temperatures continue to rise, human life as we know it will not be sustainable. And yet we're all running around pretending it's not happening. The air currents are all out of whack. We have Arctic weather in New Jersey. Meanwhile, it's warmer in Iceland. I mean, it's nuts. 40% of the summer Arctic sea ice is gone. And because the air currents are now swinging wildly, veering off course, the Arctic the temperatures are, the ice is melting at as twice the rate that climate science predicted. So, because the fossil fuel industry determines our relationship to the ecosystem, and because we as citizens have no ability to stand up and protect the next generation, and I speak as a father of four, we're betraying those who come after us. And I think that because corporate power essentially drives economic, political, and of course environmental policy, we don't have a say in what kind of a life we're going to leave our children and our grandchildren. And every climate report published says that, you know, that if we do not stop what we're doing, that it will have absolutely catastrophic consequences. So that's what I mean when I say that on the one hand, one has to be very sober about what we're doing to the planet, to the reconfiguration of the economic system into a kind of neo-feudalism. Half of this country now lives in either poverty or near poverty, while the owners of Walmart make $11,000 an hour. I mean, it's kind of insane. We've gone back to Versailles or the Forbidden City or all these other corrupt oligarchies. You can go back to ancient Rome that have brought down their nations with them, and I think that's where we are.
You've also written that, quote, "It is not the poor who make revolutions. It is those who conclude that they will not be able, as they once expected, to rise economically and socially."
That's been shown, I think, throughout history. And the anarchist Bakunin calls them de classe intellectuals, people who were trained to be lawyers or teachers or doctors, but there was no place for them within the society. That they become the kind of tinder that ignites social upheaval. And they were essentially the heart of the Occupy movement. These were kids burdened with tremendous loans. I mean, $100,000 loans, which of course our wonderful Congress has orchestrated in such a way that even if you declare bankruptcy, they still accrue interest. I mean, you can never, I guess unless you die, you're never free from them. And coupled with the fact that there are no jobs, or certainly jobs that provide sustainable incomes. And I think that Bakunin was right. By the way, that was a dispute with Marx. Marx dismissed de classe intellectuals. But I think from my own coverage of revolutions in Eastern Europe, uprisings, the street demonstrations that brought down Slobodan Milosevic, that's true. And by essentially taking the sons and daughters of the middle class and pushing them out of the mainstream, and telling them that all of their dreams and hopes and aspirations are not going to be achievable creates deep social unrest. And you know, we've seen this in Europe. We've seen it in Greece and other places with heavy Spain. I mean, heavy unemployment among the young. And we are replicating that. And I think that all sort of movements throughout history that have risen up against authoritarian forms of power have counted heavily upon these day class A intellectuals.
But you're not sure if that revolution is going to happen. I want to read one more quote from you, and you said, quote, "I do not know if we can build a better society. I do not even know if we will survive as a species. But I know these corporate forces have us by the throat, and they have my children by the throat. I do not fight fascists because I will win. I fight fascists because they are fascists."
Well, that is, you know, a reflection of coming out of seminary. And I come out of a deeply religious household. My father was a minister, and I graduated from Harvard Divinity School. And that is the notion that I fall back on, that we're called to do the good, or at least the good insofar as we can determine it. And then faith is letting it go. Faith is the belief that it goes somewhere, even if all the empirical evidence around you points otherwise. I guess the Buddhists call it karma. But that's what faith is. And I think that in times of distress, and I think we do live in a time of distress, it's important to have a vision and have faith and trust in that sense, in, you know, if we want to use a term, the unknowable, and believe that fighting for justice and standing up for what is right means something, even if all of the indicators around you seem to say that it's futile.
I have been speaking with Chris Hedges, author and journalist. Mr. Hedges, thank you so much.
Thank you.